very pleased to have Daniel Harlow continuing his lecture series on presumably black holes and quantum information.
All right. Hi. Welcome back. So today we'll talk more about black hole evaporation, entropy, black hole information problem. Should be a little bit more relaxed than yesterday. Yesterday we had to get through all this preliminary stuff with the coordinate transformations and so potentials and so on. So today things should be a little bit more conceptual. So let me first just quickly remind you where we ended up yesterday. So we had this black hole that we made out of a collapsing shell of matter. And then what we discussed was that if you look at the late modes coming out up here, you can trace them back to the initial state. And these modes will have partners inside who you can also trace back to the initial state. And then if we insist that down here we're in the ground state, so we want the initial state of the system to just have the shell that we made the black hole out of and nothing else, then these green and purple modes down here need to be entangled, right? Because we saw that if you break this entanglement, then you get these very crazy states with infinite energy sitting in between where you broke the entanglement. So then in free field theory, this entanglement just evolves up to here, which means that these purple modes, which are, the green modes fall into the singularity, we can forget about them. But the purple ones come out. And that leads to the Hawking evaporation process, which causes the mass of the black hole to gradually decrease with time. So in particular, we found that there's an evaporation time for the black hole, which is like g squared times the initial mass cubed. And we also found that we can assign a temperature to the black hole so that the structure of the radiation is as if the black hole were at a temperature, which is given by the Hawking temperature, so 1 over 8 pi g m. Okay. So we know black holes have energy, right? A black hole has a mass. The mass of the black hole is its energy. That's not as obvious as a statement as it might seem, because you have to think about, well, in gravity, how is energy defined? So that's a very interesting question. It's one which I don't really have time to get into today, but trust me, it's true that the mass of a black hole is actually its energy. Well, if a black hole has a temperature and a black hole has an energy, then it should also have an entropy, right? Because usually the way we define temperature is we say if we differentiate the entropy with respect to the energy, or here the mass, well, that's actually that's the definition of 1 over the temperature, right? So what temperature really is it tells us how entropy changes with energy. From our calculation yesterday, this is apparently equal to 8 pi gm, right? So then we can just integrate this equation to figure out what the entropy is. So apparently S is 4 pi g m squared, right? So integrate. And it's convenient to rewrite this as 4 pi times 2gm squared over 4g. This is the radius of the horizon. So this is the area of the horizon, right? 4 pi r squared. So this is the area over 4g. So this is the famous Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of a black hole. You see that we We found it by first computing the temperature by doing quantum field theory in the black hole background, and then interpreting the temperature SDSDM, or 1 over the temperature SDSDM. So let's just comment that this is a rather large entropy, right? So say M is the mass of the sun. Well, then S is something like 10 to the 78. So that's a lot of entropy, right? So the number of states is e to the 10 to the 78. I mean, for comparison, if you can try and estimate the entropy of the sun, roughly speaking, you can think of it as a gas, thermal gas, and then you get something like 10 to the 60. So you know it's large, but it's much, much smaller than the entropy of a black hole. In fact, a solar mass black hole isn't even that big. I mean, there are black holes which are much bigger than solar mass, in the centers of galaxies. And it's interesting. So, in the lecture notes I cited, it's a fun little computation. You can compare the entropy of the cosmic microwave background, the radiation gas filling the entire universe, to the entropy of the supermassive black hole, say, in the center of the Andromeda galaxy. And any guesses for which one is bigger? It's the black hole. So this one black hole in the center of one galaxy has more entropy than everything else in the universe, right? I mean, all the matter in the universe, the entropy is dominated by the CMB. I mean, so these are really huge entropies. Now, it's kind of funny. I mean, usually when we talk about this formula, the entropy is the thing that we think is fundamental, right? I mean, usually we say we take the microscopic description of the system and we count the number of microstates with energy m. And then the temperature is this sort of emergent thing where we differentiate the entropy to compute the temperature. But here we did it the other way, right? We started with the temperature, which we got from this quantum field theory calculation, and then we derived from it an entropy. Now, the obvious question then comes, is this actually an entropy, right? Is this actually counting states? It's not obvious from this calculation that that's true. You know, it could be some fake entropy. Bekenstein was really the first person who said, this is entropy. We should really interpret it as coming from counting the microstates of the black hole. So evidence for this. There are a couple things. The first is that just from studying classical general relativity, you can show the area always increases classically. So this is Hawking's famous area theorem. That's a good property for an entropy to have, right? And entropies are supposed to increase. That's the second law of thermodynamics. But here we see that Hawking showed that it was true just by solving Einstein's equations. Again, seemingly has nothing to do with counting microstates, but it behaves as if it were counting microstates, right? So Hawking also showed that. Hawking and then later work in more dynamical situations showed that indeed this equation seems to be true, the first law, so that if you take a black hole and you throw in perturbations, you throw in something that increases the energy, then the area, if we interpret the area as the entropy, then this equation seems to be true. So here we showed that sort of in equilibrium, but also this has been shown as a dynamical thing. So that's the first law of thermodynamics. So it seems both the second law and the first law of thermodynamics are true in the context of this entropy. And then more recently, well, in string theory, shows, well, in special cases, we can actually count the states and check that indeed the entropy is A over 4G. Now, we can't quite do that for Schwarzschild black holes, the ones we've been discussing here. We can almost do it. We can count the states enough to see that it grows like the area, but this 4 we can't quite get. But for more special black holes, supersymmetric black holes, we can actually count the states and see that indeed the entropy is coming from counting the states. We can reproduce that 4 from the microscopic description of the black hole. Well, then the last thing, which we'll talk about more, in ADS-CFT, we can also count the states in special cases. In particular, in ADS-3-CFT2, there's this thing called the Cardy formula. I don't know if John is here but in the audience, but he's definitely around. So John taught us how to count the states in conformal field theories, including this coefficient. And then we can compare to what we get in the bulk, and we find that it's the right coefficient. I would say, certainly for me, this convinces me that we should really think of this entropy as counting states. All right, so now let's talk about the information problem. Yeah. Yeah, it's because horizons are defined acausally, right? So if I just give you the state right now, you can't tell me where the horizons are. The horizons are defined by looking at the entire space-time and seeing where you can send signals to. So that breaks the symmetry.
So that means if you
the same. Yeah, that's right. But then the thing is a past horizon, not a future horizon. So it's a statement about future horizons. All right, any other questions? And again, please ask questions. I should repeat the questions. The question was, how is this consistent with the time reversal invariance of general relativity? Good. All right, information problem. So relativists traditionally would have said that this doesn't count state microstates, because they would have said that black holes have no hair. So relativists would have said that black holes are labeled by their mass, charge, and angular momentum. So that's not very much data. That's three parameters, right? This black hole over here, we could have made it in lots of different ways that had the same mass, charge, and angular momentum, right? We could have thrown in a dictionary, and we could have written whatever we wanted inside of the dictionary, and we could have arranged that more or less they have the same mass, charge, and angular momentum, certainly to within the widths we're using to define the ensemble where we define the entropy. So that's weird, right? Because if you really think, well, you have this black hole here, and it's only labeled by three parameters, then as soon as you make the black hole, you've lost the information about how you made the black hole, right? Because there were all these different ways you could have made it, and you only have these three parameters left. So that would violate a basic principle of physics, which is that if I give you the state of a closed system at some time, then you can evolve backwards and know what the state of the system was in an earlier time. So if black holes are really only labeled by mass, charge, and angular momentum, that would be false, right? Because if I give you the state of the black hole after it formed, then there's no way to go back and figure out what you made it out of. Now, that problem seems like it can be fixed by taking Bekenstein seriously, right? Because he says, no, those aren't really the only parameters. There's actually this whole, there's this A over 4G worth of parameters, and that should be able to keep track of how we made the black hole. Right, so then the black hole does actually remember how we made it. But what Hawking pointed out is that that's not good enough. Okay, just saying that the black hole has this entropy, which is counting the number of ways that you could have made it, isn't enough to get out of this problem with conserving the information of how we made the black hole. Okay, so Hawking's point was that, well, the problem is that this radiation that comes out is always coming out in a definite state. So basically, this radiation, well, it's just something like, let me write it in a lower line, radiation. It's just proportional to the tensor product over all these modes that we were discussing yesterday, right, which are labeled by frequency and angular momentum, of some basically thermal state. So in each mode, we have some oscillator excitation set by beta. So beta is 1 over the Hawking temperature. And then there's this absorption factors we discussed yesterday, which are gray body factors, which are the things that take into account the fact that although the system is thermal near here, it's kind of hard for the thermal stuff to get out to infinity. And so we're in the radiation, we're interested in the stuff that does get out to infinity. So that's what this keeps track of. And then just right, like this. So it's sort of thermal up to gray body factors, right? This is the actual quantum state of the radiation that comes out up here, right? And it's mixed because, as we discussed, these purple modes are entangled with these green modes, and the green modes don't get out. As the black hole evaporates, what this says, so more and more modes get populated in this way as the black hole is evaporating. So the state of the radiation is just getting more and more mixed. So we keep going. So radiation is getting mixed. So now let's think about so at some point that calculation is going to break down, right? Because the control parameter in this calculation was that the mass of the black hole in Planck units was large. So that means that this radius of curvature is large in Planck units. So this is the control parameter, okay? Now, when this was a solar mass black hole, right, so if we take this divided by that, you know, we get something like 10 to minus 40. So that's a pretty good thing to base your perturbation theory on, right? 10 to minus 40. You know, we do pretty well in electrodynamics even with 1 over 137. And you know, and I mean, 10 to the minus 40, that sounds pretty good. Okay. So we should think that this should be correct for a long time. But then eventually, you know, the black hole is evaporating. So we have m of order m Planck, eventually, right? And then this calculation will break down, and we can't use it to decide what happens then. Hawking suggested two options. Option number one is that the evaporation stops. It leaves a remnant. Okay, so good. So here we're doing quantum field theory, and now once we're allowing the black hole to evaporate, we're allowing back reaction, so we have dynamical gravity, right? So there was this g in the evaporation time. So if you like, we're doing some path integral over the metric. The matter fields, you know, phi matter, e to the is, to evolve this state from here up to here. And, well, we don't know how to do that path integral exactly because, well, we don't know how to do quantum gravity, so we don't really know how to make sense of this integral over the metric precisely. But we do know how to make sense of it in perturbation theory, perturbation theory and G. Newton. So now this might not look like we're doing perturbation theory in G. Newton, but the important thing is what we're really holding fixed, the thing that's sort of fixed here is the radius of the black hole. So we should really call this mg times 1 over square root of g. So this is the Schwarzschild radius. And so we want this to be big, but roughly speaking, we want to hold this fixed. So then to make this big, we have to make g small. So that corresponds to treating gravity perturbatively. And the excuse is that the correction should be like that, at least when the black hole is big. Oh yeah, sorry, the question was, what exactly are we doing? What exactly is this perturbation theory I mentioned? Okay, so now good. So the black hole, it's getting smaller. Now we get down to the size where it's too small for this calculation to make sense. So then we just have to guess what happens. So one thing that could happen, indeed, is the evaporation could stop, and we'd just be left with this Planckian object sitting here, which is called a remnant. This option isn't too popular these days. I don't know. I think I saw Bill Unruh around at some point. Maybe he's still holding out for this. But most people don't like this. The reason why they don't like this is because the entropy of this remnant has to be huge. Because remember, the radiation was getting more and more mixed, right? And we could have started with a huge black hole. And if we started with a huge black hole, then by the time we get down to this region, you know, all the entropy of that black hole, right? I mean, the radiation has become extremely mixed. And so to purify it, you know, by a remnant, we need this tiny little object which has a huge entropy. Actually, entropy as large as you want, because we could have started with a black hole that's as big as you want. So in order for this proposal to work, you need objects which are small, but which contain huge amounts of entropy. In fact, entropy which is much bigger than the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, okay? And so if you want this proposal to fly, you actually need to not believe this, right? Because the whole point of thinking that the entropy is counting the microstates is that you actually think the entropy is counting the microstates. And so in order to have remnants to work, you need to have these things which are kind of like black holes but have much more entropy than this. But then why would any of this stuff be true, right? So usually this... We don't like this option. Okay. Option number two. And I should say, by the way, this was also the option that Ted was complaining to me at the beginning of the class yesterday. So now that's the reason why we don't like it. Okay. Option number two is that the evaporation finishes. Rho radiation is just mixed. So this is the option which is usually called information loss, right? Because we started with the black hole in a pure state. We evolved it for a long time. It evaporated. Now we're just left with the Hawking radiation, photons, gravitons, neutrinos, whatever else is around. But those are all in a mixed state, okay? But that's information loss again, right? Because it's the same mixed state, right? It's just a stupid mixed state. So, you know, we had a pure state that evolved to a mixed state, and even worse, the mixed state didn't remember which pure state we started with. Okay. So this is called information loss. This is what Hawking originally argued for when he made this argument. Maybe that's true. You know, maybe it's true. Yeah, sorry. Oh, well, yeah, but then the thing is, right. So I guess you could imagine that there's a remnant, but that the remnant doesn't purify the rest of the radiation. But then there's really no point in having the remnant, right? I mean, you know, if you're gonna have these awful objects with huge entropy, I mean, you might as well do something with them, right? I mean, yeah. Otherwise, it's kind of not really that different. Okay, fine. There's an extra little particle of radiation that comes out or something. You know. Yeah. When you say remnant, you mean something that purifies the radiation. Okay. So both of these options don't seem really too appealing, right? there's a secret option, the secret third option, which doesn't seem to be allowed by this calculation that we've been discussing, which is that rho radiation is pure. And it just looks thermal, because we didn't look carefully enough. And then if we looked really carefully at this rho radiation after the black hole evaporated, then actually it would be in a pure state. And it just looks thermal because, you know, pure states usually look thermal, right? It's hard to tell a pure state from a thermal state unless you're really careful. This is actually the secret option is the most popular option these days. I think probably it's the only one that's really consistent with this idea that entropy is actually counting states. If you're having information loss, then somehow you're not, you know, it's kind of, you don't get much by thinking of it as counting states because the information is lost. But before we just sort of happily adopt option three, I want to emphasize that it has its problems too, right? Because we're doing perturbation theory in this. How can it be wrong, right? I mean, we're saying, you know, if we adopt option three, we're saying we don't believe in this perturbation theory, right? In quantum field theory, coupled perturbatively to gravity. And that's crazy, right? I mean, or at least it seems crazy. I mean, you know, we've tested gravity and quantum field theory to, you know, perturbation theory all the time, and so far it's always worked, right? So if you think that option three is correct, you have to tell me where the mistake was in the calculation that led to this. In these lectures I've only sketched it, so it's, you know, if there's a mistake, and there might be a mistake, well, I'll be impressed if any of you found it, but I don't know what it is, although I'll suggest something that it might be in a minute. Question? Yeah. I don't think it helps. Yeah. I don't want to get into that now because I think it just doesn't help. But anyone who wants to ask me about that in private, I'll tell you why it doesn't help. Oh, sorry. The question was about, well, maybe I shouldn't repeat that question to the recording. Okay.
So you mentioned that it's very hard to distinguish a pure state from a
mixed state. Well, good. So the question is, what are we computing correctly to this accuracy? The question was, okay, if it's hard to tell a pure state from a mixed state, maybe that just lies in this, you know, down in this 10 to the minus 40, and that's fine, right? That was the question, right? Yeah. So good. So the question is, what are we accurately computing to this accuracy, right? Like, if we computed this state to accuracy 10 to the minus 40 in the trace norm, then it's definitely, then small corrections like that aren't going to save you, right? So if a state is, if you have a state which is mixed to accuracy 10 to the minus 40 in the trace norm, it's mixed. It's not close to a pure state. It's very far from a pure state, right? I mean, you know, not even, right? So. And the problem is that, at least naively, it seems like this calculation goes through at the level of the state. You know, it's not like we computed the first few photons or some, you know, first 10 photons or something, and that's okay. But then the errors can pile up, and that's something that really has been emphasized recently by the firewall arguments, and especially by the work of Samir Mathur, who studied exactly this question of, okay, so if you just consider, you know, small perturbations, you know, photon by photon as it's coming out, somehow can that be enough to purify? And the answer is no. I mean, you really need to change it a lot in order to purify. We'll see maybe a bit more of that about that in a minute. So let me comment on it further then. All right, any other questions? Okay. So all these options are bad, and that's why it's called the black hole information problem, right? That's why it's still a problem. That's why I'm giving a talk about it. Okay. So maybe this one seems the least bad, but it's still bad. Now, by way of making excuses for option three, let me just say one place where that one thing that might make you think that Hawking's calculation is actually wrong, within the way that we've done it. So this is called the Trans-Planckian problem. So the Trans-Planckian problem is the observation that if you look at these modes in this calculation, there's actually, as you follow them back here, they get more and more blue shifted. And the later that you think of this purple mode as coming out, the more they get blue shifted as you go back through here. So that's just a fact about this geometry. And in fact, if you look at, so you can compute the center of mass energy of the collision of these photons coming back, or gravitons or whatever they are, and this infalling shell. And what you find is that the square root, oh, maybe that's kind of particle physics. Okay, let me call it the center of mass energy, E center of mass, also called square root of S, of this collision here. Well, what is it like? So it's like, the energy of the radiation going out and the energy of the shell in the square, geometric mean, so that doesn't sound so bad. But then you find actually that it grows exponentially fast in the time of when this photon comes out after when the shell went in. Okay, so that's exponentially fast, right? So that means that for t, delta t, of order, let's say RS log of the entropy, E center of mass is of order M Planck. So maybe that's not totally obvious, right? The idea is that M Planck here, so the entropy is like M over M Planck squared. Okay. If I put so the key thing is to just get an M Planck down here, which is M Planck in the log up here. And then we just fill in the units with the mass or the R. Schwarzschild and so on. So this means that after a time which isn't that long, I mean, notice that this is called the scrambling time. And it's much shorter than this, right? I mean, this is only logarithmic in the mass of the black hole, whereas this is a power. So this time is very short compared to the evaporation time. And you could worry that, after this time, we don't really know how to do this calculation. Okay, that's called the Trans-Planckian problem. Now, of course, there are arguments that still we know how to do the calculation despite this. There's something called the nice slice argument. There's also, the thermodynamic argument I mentioned before based on trying to put things in equilibrium. But I would say this illustrates that this is a kind of a UV-sensitive question, right, at least. And the answer might be that you're just allowed to evolve through the shell. I mean, naively, that's what you guess, because you think the shell is kind of diffuse, so very, very high-energy things will just go through it in the same way that a very high-energy cosmic ray will probably just go through me, because, I'm not that dense. So, high-energy cosmic ray will just, go straight through, won't do much. But that's an assumption. I mean, maybe at the Planck scale, things are different. Maybe it'll make a black hole or something. So at least for me, this is at least one reason why I might be willing to take option three more seriously. Okay. Now, I want to say one more thing, just briefly. This is something that actually Dan Roberts talked about in his lecture yesterday. So there's a nice way of organizing these questions of, is the radiation pure, is the radiation not pure, so on, which is called the Page curve. So the idea of the Page curve is that Well, we make the black hole by throwing in some stuff. And then there's some quantum gravity that goes on here, which we don't understand. But there's this cloud of Hawking radiation that comes out. Okay. And then the idea of Page is that we just split this radiation into two parts, an early part and a late part. And so we'll call the early part R, because it's sort of, if you like, the radiation that's already come out. And we'll call the second part BH for black hole, because, you know, at this time, this is the radiation that was still inside of the black hole at the time that, that this was emitted, right? And then Page's proposal, so we can call the where we do this T. And Page's idea is that what we should look at is we should look at SR of T. So that's called the Page curve. We look at the von Neumann entropy of the radiation cloud as a function of time, right? And so we, to be rigorous about that, we can do it at future infinity, and we can just split the radiation into the early and the late part. So then it's really a statement about the S matrix of this theory. It's not a thing that requires you to go into the bulk. And therefore, it's a thing which should actually be well-defined in quantum gravity. That's the real nice thing about the Page curve. So let's see what it looks like for information loss and for unitarity. So this is usually called unitarity, right? The idea is the evolution that produces this pure state will be unitary. Information loss, well, here's SR, and here's T. Let's put T evaporation here. And then the idea is just, we start at zero, right? Because, you know, when this is here, radiation is empty, so entropy is zero. And then it grows, because we just keep getting more modes into this state. And it just keeps growing until we get to T evaporation, and then it just saturates. Because now we've got, now R is all of this, and it's just sitting there in a mixed state, right? So that's this saturation here. It's in the question mark. So here now the idea is a black hole is just this thing we made. So there's something going on here that we don't really understand. So in this picture, the question mark is kind of this. So remember, for the evaporating black hole, we found ourselves wanting to extend it up like that eventually, right? And so this extension up here is like this part, and then down here is before we had the black hole. But the question was, where's the horizon? It's in the question mark. This is the Page curve for information loss. We can also compute the Page curve for unitarity. And then the idea is that, here's T evaporation again. So then if the evaporation is unitary, then, it starts out the same. It starts going up. But then eventually, once all the radiation comes out, it's got to be in a pure state. So then it must come back down to zero. Okay? And then there's a question of what happens in between. That's what Dan Roberts was telling you a little bit about. I'll say a little bit more, but in some sense, it must go up and then come back down. Okay. So this is unitarity. And actually, Andy Strominger, my current employer, says that if someone tells you they solved the information problem, you should ask them for this function. Okay. You don't get to say you solved the information problem until you can compute this function. And I think he's right about that. So let me just say a little bit more about why this curve goes up and down, and then we'll move on to ADS-CFT. How do we know the structure of this curve? Well, the key idea. So we know this from something called Page's theorem. Page. So he wasn't actually able to compute the curve, right? So he can't make Andy happy, but he can make some plausible assumptions and then tell us what the curve does. So the assumptions are basically that, you know, this system is evolving, that this state here is a very complicated state. And in fact, it's so complicated, we can assume it's typical. Okay, that's the assumption of Page. We assume that whatever you put in here, the dynamics of this black hole or quantum gravity, they're very complicated. So then the state that comes out here shouldn't have any particular special structure with respect to this split into early and late radiation. Yeah?
How good of an assumption is that assuming the state is typical
and what you mean by typical? Yeah, so you have, right, so well, we're gonna say a little bit of that, but roughly speaking, you have to take conservation laws into account. So you know this state better have the same energy as the thing that you sent in, same angular momentum and charge and so on. And the idea is, other than that, you just assume it's Haar random. Well, I don't know. I guess I'd have to know how to compute that curve to tell you, wouldn't I? Usually it's not that hard for stuff to look Haar random. So okay, so let me just, for those of you who like these things. So you know, Haar random sounds very hard. I mean, it's not actually Haar random, right? I mean, because, you know, probably we can simulate it in polynomial time and so on, so it's not really going to be Haar random. But the thing is, this is not a very sophisticated observable, this SR. It doesn't involve that high powers of unitary, the random unitary. So it just needs to look random if you look at a few powers of the unitary. So for example, there are things called two designs. It's two design randomness is good enough for this to work. And that's the kind of thing you could get by, well, and can get by evolving for polynomial time. Okay, so, I should have said that later. So let's first state the theorem. So the theorem says that if I have a Hilbert space that factorizes into HA times HB, for simplicity, I'll assume that A is less than or equal to B, that loss of generality, then the idea is that a generic state in this Hilbert space is going to look maximally mixed on A. Okay, so that's the intuitive statement. The rigorous statement is like this. So we say that let me first define I'll call psi. How shall I say this? So I'll define rho A of U. So that's like the density matrix here for a random state, to be like the trace over B of U zero, U dagger. So the idea is here, we just pick some arbitrary state, call it zero, doesn't matter what it is. We act on it with a unitary, random unitary, and then we trace over B, and we call that rho A of U. Okay. So then the idea is now we're going to average over this U the distance between rho A of U the identity matrix on A. So this tells you on average how close is this state rho A to being maximally mixed. Right? And so what Page's theorem tells us, Dan Roberts explained in his talk yesterday, is that this is less than square root of A over B. To be clear, these are the dimensionalities of A and B. So this tells you that if B is really even a little bit bigger than A, typically rho A is maximally mixed. Okay. So for example, say these are qubits, and say that each of them has a million qubits, but that B has 20 more qubits than A. Then we win exponentially, right? So then this would be like 2 to minus 10. So, 10 qubits is not that many out of a million or billion or trillion. It doesn't even matter. It just matters how much more you have. So then we can use this to estimate this curve, because we just have to estimate the sizes of the relevant Hilbert spaces here. So we have to figure out sort of how much of this radiation could possibly be populated by the radiation, and how much entropy is left in the black hole. At early times, the radiation is very small compared to the remaining black hole, right? Because so far maybe only. Oh yes, question. This is IA. Yeah, sorry. The identity on A. Yeah. So at early times, not much radiation has come out yet, so there's not much room. There's not much entropy, even coarse grained entropy in the radiation. SR is just log of R. Okay. And we can estimate that. So this is just the coarse-grained entropy of the radiation that has come out so far. So you remember from yesterday, the radiation all comes out in the low angular momentum modes, like L equals 0. So it's basically a one-dimensional problem. You're just sort of asking how much entropy is there in a one-dimensional photon gas. And then the answer is it's linear in the size of the gas, which here is just the time since the black hole started evaporating. So this just goes like the time times T, the temperature. So it starts out growing linearly. Yeah. Yeah. So for convenience, we were doing the slice at null infinity. Yeah, it's okay. You can, if you want to make it space like, that's okay. We can just do something like that. Okay. So this starts out growing linearly, and then that's going to continue until we get up to the crossover point, where the coarse grain entropy of the radiation is comparable to the coarse grain entropy of the remaining black hole. That's called the page time. So this is T page here. And then at late times, we'll have that the radiation has much more entropy than the black hole. So now it'll be the black hole that's maximally mixed, right? And then since it's the black hole that's maximally mixed, well, since the whole thing is in a pure state, that tells us that the radiation is now just going to be log of the entropy, or it's log of the dimensionality of the remaining black hole. And this is getting smaller, right? Because the black hole is getting smaller. And remember, this is just A over 4G of the remaining black hole. So as A goes to 0, this goes to 0. And so eventually this turns over. Now, if you actually work out what it looks like, it's not quite linear going back down. It kind of curves over and goes down like some power like that. So this was Page's computation of what the page curve should look like. Now again, to be clear, he didn't do what Andy wants. He didn't compute it microscopically from quantum gravity. He just argued using typicality that it should look like this. And then the thing I wanted to emphasize in the context of this perturbation theory, right, is that, I mean, from the point of view of the state, this is a huge change, right? Like here the entropy is just going up, and then over, right? Whereas here it now has to turn over somewhere in the middle and go back down to 0. So that's a large perturbation. It's not a 10 to the minus 40 perturbation. Yes? You first.
Are there any restrictions on that state 0?
No, totally arbitrary, because U is a random unitary. So it's in, so the state I get is invariant on which one I choose to start with. Yeah.
In this case, if you're thinking about unity time solution, so the process, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So that's why. So yeah, and that was the thing that Dan was harassing me about too. That's right. Yeah. So in the real system, this will probably be smoothed out a bit at the top because of that. But down here and down here, it should be the same. Yeah. That's right. Tarun was complaining that I didn't take into account energy conservation here, which is true, and he was also suggesting, as he knows very well, that the sharpness of this transition is less sharp once you include conservation laws. So that's true. But the basic form of the curve is still right. So that's basically all I wanted to say about evaporating black holes. So these are the options. We like this option, but it comes with its own baggage too. So now I'm going to change gears and talk about ADS CFT, and see what that tells us about the information problem. So Mukund and Veronica, and then also Shidong in his lectures, told you a lot about ADS CFT already. And we're not exactly, don't have huge amounts of time left. So I'm just going to say a little bit about the correspondence at the beginning, and then I'm going to jump to probably what is the most interesting thing to think about in the context of the information problem. Okay, so you know, the basic idea, ADS CFT. New piece of chalk. Is that, well, we have quantum gravity going on in this asymptotically ADS space, and it's supposed to be equivalent, isomorphic at the level of quantum mechanics to quantum field theory living on the boundary of the space with no gravity, g equals zero. In the lecture tomorrow, I'll say a lot more about how this could possibly be true. Isn't that crazy? Different numbers of dimensionalities in these theories and so on. So that kind of stuff I won't discuss today. So today, we're just going to assume that this is true. So in particular, there's a dictionary which tells us, well, that states correspond to states. So the Hilbert space is isomorphic. The symmetry generators correspond to symmetry generators. So the asymptotic symmetries of gravity here, the Hamiltonian, angular momentum, and so on, defined at infinity, act in this Hilbert space in the same way as in the conformal field theory. The Hamiltonian and angular momentum, conformal transformations all act. And then finally, the key line in the dictionary is that if we take a bulk field in the gravity theory and we pull it to the boundary, then we get a local operator in the conformal field theory. And this is an operator equation. This is supposed to be true throughout the Hilbert space. And this is the thing that really allows us to map observables between one side of the correspondence and the other. Here I wrote a scalar field, but there's also the metric, which corresponds to the energy momentum tensor in the CFT. And if there's a gauge field, that corresponds to a conserved current in the CFT. We're predominantly interested in the situation. So what is this ADS anyway, right? We're interested in states where the geometry, at least asymptotically, let me write it this way. Asymptotically approaches just empty anti de Sitter space, which is like this, plus r squared d omega squared. So that's anti de Sitter space. And this has this scale in it, this L, right? So this is usually called LADS. Let me write that. And this is the radius of curvature of the ADS. And then usually, the theories that we like have the property that LADS divided by L Planck is much larger than 1, okay? So we want this radius of curvature to not be very small, like not be of order the Planck scale. If it was, then this would be a rather uninteresting gravity theory. Certainly nothing like that is true in our world. So this parameter is the thing that you sometimes hear being called N or C or various other things, depending on which context people are talking about it. But in the bulk, it's always just this. In ADS CFT, the first thing we can do is the ground state is just the ground state. That's kind of boring. But there are other states, of course, which are also interesting. So the simplest kinds of other states we can consider in the bulk are just states where various fields living in the bulk are excited. So we learned yesterday that the way to think about those is you figure out what are the set of modes of the solution of the wave equation in this background, and then you study those modes, and that tells you about the kind of physics that's going on here. So because of time, I'm not going to go through that whole thing again today, but let me just draw a picture. So it's fairly similar. You end up with some potential V of this thing like R star for the radial modes. And then this R star is, I think, inverse tangent of R. And then What you find is that the potential looks like this. So the boundary of the spacetime is that r star equals pi over 2. The center of the spacetime is that r star equals 0. And then you see this is basically like a particle in a box, right? So, you know, first problem you solved in your quantum mechanics class. So the modes here are going to correspond to standing waves, which are just sitting in the center of the bulk, you know, confined inside. So this is like a box. And then the allowed frequencies will be quantized as you go up. So that's the sense in which, you know, so this is why we say that ADS-CFT puts gravity in a box. Right? That's the slogan you should think of for ADS-CFT. You know, the particles in here sort of stay confined in the middle. There's a potential that keeps them away from the boundary, and here's that potential. And in fact, we know, you know, all the various excited states, you know, particles zipping around here or there, different states in the possible gas of gravitons and photons and whatever in the bulk. We know how to represent those explicitly as states in the CFT, and that's what Qidong was explaining in his focus lectures the last couple days. So those are the sort of low energy excitations of the states in the CFT and also in the bulk, since they're isomorphic. But OK, that's kind of boring. I mean, if that's all there was to gravity, we wouldn't be having this workshop. So the thing that's really interesting is that, well, we also have black holes. So there's an ADS version of the Schwarzschild geometry, which I'm sure you've seen in the lectures before, but let me just quickly write it down again. So far it just looks like the ordinary Schwarzschild geometry, but I have to tell you what this F is. So this F of R, well, it's R over L ADS squared plus 1. So far it just looks like the vacuum here. But then there's an extra term. Which is like that. I should just to establish some convention. I'm always doing ADS d plus 1 CFT d. So d is the space-time dimension of the CFT. So there's this extra thing here. And this alpha is the thing that sets the mass of the black hole. So 16 pi gm over d minus 1 omega d minus 1. Where omega d minus 1 is just the area of a d minus 1 dimensional sphere, the surface area of a d minus 1 dimensional sphere. But the numbers don't matter. You just have to remember this is like the mass. Then the Schwarzschild radius is defined to be the place where this is 0. That's the location of the horizon. There's two sort of interesting limits. So one thing that can happen is that RS can be much less than LADS, okay? So if that's true, then in this equation, we can ignore this term, right? Because the one here will be bigger than that term. So then F of R is just 1 minus alpha over R d minus 2. So RS to d minus 2. Is just alpha. Okay, so these are called small black holes. These are black holes where their size is small compared to the ADS radius of curvature, and they more or less just behave like ordinary Minkowski space black holes, right? So they're small. You know, I mean, that would be like astrophysical black holes in our universe, right? We have a cosmological constant. You know, its radius is, you know, 10 to the 4 parsecs, 10 to the 4 megaparsecs. Whereas the black holes, right, the radius, the kind of radii that we get, you know, at most they're of order the size of the solar system or something. So much, much smaller than the radius of curvature of the cosmological constant. So small black holes. Small. But then we can also have big black holes, where the Schwarzschild radius is much bigger than the ADS radius. And well, those are the ones where, so now f of r is approximately r over l squared minus r minus alpha over r d minus 2. So then rs apparently is, well, rs to the d minus 4 is alpha, I guess, times some power of L squared. So okay, alpha L squared. Okay. So these are big black holes. And so big black holes are interesting. So if we take a time slice through this ADS like that, and we look at it from above, then you know, so these are the kinds of pictures people like to draw angels and demons on, right? These sort of hyperbolic plane pictures. When you have a big black hole, most of this is just filled up by the black hole. So, you know, it's occupying most of the volume. So this box is mostly full of the black hole. There's just a little bit of space outside for the radiation. And so then the radiation is kind of out here bouncing back and forth. Now, the interesting thing here is that these guys behave differently. Because, well, the small ones, if they're small enough, they're just going to evaporate, right? Because, you know, they'll evaporate into radiation. But they'll have evaporated before the radiation, you know, knows that it's in this box. But the big black holes, they also try to evaporate. But then there's this boundary, right, where, you know, because the radiation is in a box. And so the Hawking radiation just gets fed back into the black hole. So it doesn't evaporate. It just sits there forever. So it's called eternal black hole. So these big black holes are eternal. So I guess Mukin probably talked about that in his lecture. Yes? What? Yeah, that's right. But the relevant thing is this potential. So this potential is the thing that controls sort of how the modes behave. So it's true that if you sort of look at the volume out there, it's infinite. But from the point of view of solving the wave equation, the thing is that you can get out and back in finite time. So that's the amazing thing about anti-de Sitter space. Like, if I'm in here and I have a flashlight and I shine the flashlight away from me, well, it turns around and comes back. And I see it in a finite time, which is of order the ADS radius. Which kind of makes sense, right? Positive cosmological constant stuff gets accelerated away from you faster and faster. So negative stuff comes back to you, right? So living in ADS is like, you know, everybody's a boomerang, right? You know, you throw the baseball away from you, and it comes back in a finite time. Good. So at least roughly speaking, big black holes are stable, small black holes are unstable. So now let's talk about the information problem. So we can first just try and discuss the information problem as we've already thought about it so far. And then it's clearly going to have to be about the small black holes. This one is a little bit harder to explain. There are some technical issues, which I would say haven't totally been resolved to the satisfaction of everybody. But here's the basic idea. So here's our ADS. The idea is, so we know this dictionary. So we know how to make, by using this, we know how to make the infalling shell that creates a black hole. We just take the ground state and the CFT, and then we act with some operator, which these days people might like to call W, which sends in this infalling shell. Which then eventually collapses, forms a black hole, small black hole. And the small black hole sits there for a while, but then, you know, Hawking kicks in, and eventually it evaporates back into radiation. And we can describe that process in the CFT. Remember, the Hamiltonian is equal to the Hamiltonian by just acting on this with e to the minus I ht. And then, so let's call that psi of t. And then if we wait for long enough, then eventually, since for small black holes, most of the states of the system correspond to these radiation kind of states and not to these black hole kinds of states, that generically we'll land in a state which is almost all radiation, okay? And provably almost all radiation, because using the machinery that based on this, which she described in his lectures, you know, you can actually figure out, given the state, what is the state of the radiation field in the bulk, right? Like which photons are where and how they're entangled with who and so on. Okay. The only thing you need is that most of the states in this energy band are radiation and not black holes. The small loophole is really making sure that that statement is true. If it's not, then the whole picture breaks down at a much more basic level. But as long as the correspondence is even close to being correct, then this state will be almost all radiation, and then we'll have computed the S matrix, right? I'll have told you the pure state that comes out of the evaporation. So if the correspondence is true, at least, then small black holes evaporate unitarily, at least in this model. All right. Now, that's only half the story for ADS-CFT, though, because Juan Malsena, who was around earlier this week, well, in addition to giving us the correspondence in the first place, he also taught us that there's a version of the information problem, even for the large black holes, and that's not totally obvious, right? The large ones aren't evaporating, so how can they have an information problem? But they do, and in fact, what he explained is not only do they have an information problem, their information problem is easier to understand than the one for the small black holes. Yeah. Oh yeah, no. So that we don't know, right? So I just did the evolution in the CFT. So I was given the in state and I computed the out state and hey, look, it's pure. But I didn't tell you what was wrong with Hawking's calculation. Yeah. And I should, right? So yeah, indeed. So this you can say solves the problem in the sense of telling you the answer. But as was once emphasized to me emphatically by Edward Witten, knowing something is true does not mean knowing why it's true. Yes. Yeah, sure. So the question was the degrees of freedom at the singularity, what do they correspond to in CFT? So the thing is, we don't really know. That's not really how the CFT organizes itself. I mean, so I know the Hilbert space of the CFT, and I know, roughly speaking, which states in that Hilbert space correspond to the states of big black holes, or even some of the small ones, like this one where I collapsed the shell. But from the point of view of the CFT, the information is all here at the boundary. And so it's not totally clear which thing corresponds to which thing in the bulk. So for the radiation gas, I know the answer. I can tell you, you know, which thing I need to change in the CFT state to change something about the radiation gas in the bulk. But I don't know how to do that for the interior of the black hole. And it doesn't seem like that's a minor bookkeeping thing. I mean, it seems like there may be a, in principle, problem with being able to do that. So unfortunately, I don't have time to get into that today, but that's related to this firewall paradoxes, right? So indeed, some people would say the modern version of the information problem is to know, so now we all assume that the evaporation is unitary, but then the challenge is to understand how to describe the interior of the black hole in the language where the unitarity is manifest. And I don't know. So it's not a stupid question at all. I mean, that is the hardest question in the field that we're all trying to solve. Yeah. Okay, any other questions? Okay. So now let's talk about the information problem for big black holes. So Juan Maldacena's idea was that, you know, rather than doing these complicated scattering experiments, what we should really think about, so this is now big BH, info problem. So what Juan told us is that what we should really think about is just a very simple thing. We just look in the thermal ensemble of the CFT at a temperature which is high enough where we expect the big black hole to dominate the ensemble. And then we just look at the real-time two-point function of some simple fields, you know, in the CFT. Just look at this two-point function. What could be simpler? The thermal two-point function. But what he explained was that, well, if we think about this two-point function in the bulk, and I'll explain both of these statements in more detail, but just to warm you up, the bulk would tell us that the limit as t goes to infinity of g of t is 0. Okay, I'll explain why in a sec. Whereas the CFT, or if you like, unitarity, would tell us that the long time average of this correlation function in the limit that the time we average over goes to infinity is of order e to the minus s, which is small, but it's not 0. So this is Juan's information problem. What could be simpler, right? You know, we just have the stupid two-point function. You can put it on a computer. Well, the Hawking's calculation, or the big ADS black hole version of it, tells you that this correlation function goes to 0. So now, that is information loss, right? Because it's saying that if you make a measurement at early times, you know, which you can think of as disturbing the system in some way, and then you ask at late times, is there anything that, you know, is it correlated even a little bit with doing the same measurement at late times? And if information is lost, the answer should be no. You know, whatever you did earlier, it should have fallen into the black hole, and the information is gone. So this thing you do at late times shouldn't be correlated with it. So that's what this says. Now, we can understand that a little more explicitly. Mukin presumably wrote down for you this Penrose diagram. So this is the Penrose diagram of the ADS-Schwarzschild geometry. And then remember this O, it just corresponds to the boundary value of some field in the bulk. So the idea is here we have some phi of 0, and up here we have some phi of t. In the bulk, we can look at this correlation function. Now, the idea is that, this you can actually just compute in the ADS-Schwarzschild geometry. And you see that it goes like e to minus t for arbitrarily late times. So indeed, it has this behavior. I was going to give you a heuristic argument for that based on Rindler space, but I think because time is limited, you can look in my lecture notes if you want to see it. Basically, you can just check that in Rindler space, if you look at this two-point function, right? So Rindler space is thermal, and it's kind of like the black hole. So, and you can check in Rindler space that indeed this goes like that. Then the picture is from the bulk, if we plot g of t, it's a function of t, well, it starts out order 1 and then it just decays exponentially forever. So the black hole rapidly thermalizes the perturbation and it never remembers it. Plausible, right? Well, certainly if you think black holes destroy information. What about in the CFT? Well, now we can just compute it. I guess we want to do trace e to minus beta h. We can insert a complete set of energy eigenstates here, get O of t. Then we can insert another complete set of energy eigenstates here, and then get O of 0, and then we close the trace. All right. Hopefully that algebra everyone can follow. Churning through here, we get that this is sum over I and j, e to minus beta ei plus I ei minus ej with a t. Something like this, Oij, absolute value squared, all right? So you see here I just used that this is e to the iht, O of 0, e to the minus iht, right? Heisenberg evolution. And then you see the h's are always acting on these eigenstates, so I can turn them into these phases. And this guy is acting on an eigenstate, so I can also just stick in an e there, all right? This symbol here, Oij, it's just the matrix elements of O of 0. All right. We can also estimate the long time average of this. So let's compute 1 over t integral dt. Since this doesn't have definite sign, we're going to compute the average of the absolute value squared of this thing. Okay. So we can just substitute this in, get the following thing. So 1 over z squared sum, and now we have ij I prime j prime, so sum over 4 indices. And then we get two things. So we get an e to minus beta EI plus EI prime. We get a OIJ squared and a OI prime J prime squared. And then we get some factor from this integral, which is like this. So 1 over t integral 0 to t dt, and then just some phases. So in particular, EI minus EJ plus EJ prime minus EI prime times t. All right? So it's a little tedious, but not too bad. Now, the point is, now the time average has all just gone into these oscillating phases here, right? So let's think about how we think this quantity is going to behave. So say that the e's here are all different, right? So that this exponent here, so that the thing in the phase here is not zero. Well, then we're doing a very long time average over this thing, so it's just going to oscillate. It's going to average to zero, right? So the only way this is not going to be zero in the long time limit is if this thing is zero, so that the phases are all one, right? Because remember, in the end, we're interested in taking the limit as t goes to infinity here. So really, it'll be zero, unless these guys are equal. Moreover, now here we're going to start making assumptions about the structure of the CFT. We think that the CFT is a chaotic system. So we think that there are not large amounts of degeneracies amongst these e's. There aren't. So that basically the only way that we can get this to vanish is to vanish pairwise, right? So to either cancel these two and these two, or to cancel these two and these two, all right? But there are things like that. So the easiest way to do that is just have the states be the same, right? So say that I equals I prime and J equals J prime, right? So then this is one, right? Because this is one and we're just averaging one over something, you know, right? Dt and then dividing by t, so this is one. So already we've learned that this is not zero in the large t limit, right? Because there are terms in the sum where this bracketed thing is just one, and then now all the time dependence is gone, right? So then since these terms are finite and positive, so you see there can't be cancellations here, right? This is positive and these are positive. So we've already discovered that this long time average isn't going to be zero. Okay, so we've already ruled out the information loss answer. But you know, we'd like to say a little bit more than that. I mean, in particular, we'd like to get this e to the minus s. Okay, so the last 10 minutes of the lecture, I'm going to explain the e to the minus s. For simplicity, okay, so good. So we know g does not go to zero. But is it e to the minus s? All right. So I'm going to make an assumption just to make life simpler, which is that I'm going to assume there's a symmetry that sends O to minus O. So for example, like in phi to the fourth theory, right, there's a symmetry. Phi goes to minus phi. And what that means, if you think about it for a little bit, Maybe you want it to be a homework assignment, I don't know, is that we can always have OII equals zero. So in other words, in any energy eigenstate, the one-point function of O is zero, right? Because this OII, right? It's the where did I write it? It's the one-point function of O in an eigenstate. Okay. So if I have a symmetry, then I can always arrange for that to be zero. And so that's good. That makes my life a little bit easier. In particular, in this sum, that gets rid of the term of the possible solution where I equals j and j prime equals I prime, right? Because then these are zero there. So then the only way for this to be non-zero is I equals I prime and j equals j prime. Okay, good. Now, so that of course it doesn't seem like too crazy of an assumption. I mean, of course it won't be true in all theories, but there are certainly interesting theories where it is true. To go further, we're going to have to assume that these O's have some sort of well-behavedness, right? Because so far these were just arbitrary operators. I mean, they could be anything. And clearly, if I'm just allowed to have them be anything that I want whatsoever, then I'm not going to get that, right? I mean, I can get anything I want. So I want to put conditions on these O's that make them like these local operators in the conformal field theory that are dual to these bulk fields at the boundary. Right, so I want them to be, you know, that kind of operator. So then the question is, what are the properties of that kind of operator? And can we use those properties to get this e to the minus s? So actually, there's a lecture this afternoon about this. So this goes under the name of eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. Okay, and Marcus Muller, maybe he's here, I don't know, I don't see him, but is going to explain the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis in more detail. But let me just tell you a little bit. It'll be enough to get the e to the minus s. This is a question which is very interesting for many reasons, which is why we decided it was worthy of its own lecture. Condensed matter physicists also very interested in the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. So I'm just going to do something a little sneaky, though. So the idea is I'm going to look at g of zero, the correlation function, just without any, you know, without going to a long time separation, just a short time separation. So then that's just 1 over z, sum on I not equal to j, e minus beta ei, oij, absolute value squared. Okay, and I'm going to ask that this has two nice properties. So the first property is that I want it to be order 1. Okay, because in the bulk, if you look at this correlation function at small time separation, it should be order 1. Now, okay, you might complain that there's a UV divergence when I really bring them together, so maybe I should have left a little bit of time separation there. That's okay. You can get rid of that by integrating these fields over test functions, and then you're allowed to bring them together, and they'll be order 1. So these O's you should think of as being the local operators smeared a little bit just to get rid of the UV issues. Okay. So I want this to be order 1, and moreover, I want it to be a reasonably smooth function of beta. So it would be kind of crazy if I changed beta a little bit, and then this correlation function changed a lot, right? I mean, that's certainly not what would happen in the bulk, and it's also not what we expect to happen in the conformal field theory for these local operators. In order to achieve those two things, we need to make a few assumptions about O. So the first thing, okay, so maybe let me write it over here. Let me write it here. Okay, so ETH, which is roughly speaking going to be this list of things. So the first thing we want is we want the absolute value of Oij to fall off with j fast enough the sum such that we're dominated, such that EI of order EJ of order the expectation value of H in the thermal ensemble dominates. Right. So if you look at the sum, you see it looks like the sum over J, if you just look at these factors, it looks like it might not converge, right? So this exponential might help with the convergence of the I sum. But it's not going to help with the convergence of the J sum. So what we need is that this O can't mix I with states J with much higher energy. Because if it could, then this sum might not converge, or at least it might be very large. Okay. So roughly speaking, that's saying we want to think of O as a probe. O is an operator which does not mix states of wildly different energy very much. So, and from the CFT point of view, that's what the smearing accomplishes. So that's a restriction on the matrix elements of O. We also want that. So let's say what I want is that. Let me write it up here. That EI minus EJ in absolute value is much less than the expectation value of the Hamiltonian. That's good enough. You can even probably put a square root and it's still fine. But. Yeah, but so are EI and EJ. Yeah. That's why you're allowed to put a square root or something. But it doesn't matter too much. This is a very generous bound to put on it, and it's already good enough. Usually you can put a better bound than that. So then the other thing I need. That makes the sum converge, but I still want the sum to be order one, right? Finite doesn't necessarily mean order one. So if I want it to be order one, well, let's think about how to estimate this sum, right? So very crudely, z goes like e to the s, right? Z is the partition function. So s is the thermal entropy. The sum over I and j goes like e to the 2s. So it's because we've arranged so that only the terms which are in this energy band are important. So roughly speaking, there's 2s terms because we're summing over two things in the sum. So this is like e to the minus s, and this is like e to the 2s. So if I want this to be order 1, then I need this to be order e to the minus s, right? Because 2s, right, so this is like e to the minus s, this is like e to the 2s, so this had better be e to the minus s to get something that's order 1, right? This implies that the order of magnitude of Oij is e to minus s over 2, okay? So that's good. We need one more thing. Now we've guaranteed that it's finite and moreover that it's order one. The last thing we want to ensure is that it's a smooth function of beta, right? So because it would be weird if it depended very sensitively on the temperature. So then the last thing we want is that Oij varies. Smoothly in EI and EJ. Okay. So if that's true, then we can essentially replace the sum by an integral, and then we get an analytic function of beta. All right? So these three things, that O doesn't mix states of wildly different energy, that O is of order e to minus s over 2, and that its absolute value varies smoothly, are what are called the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, stated in terms of properties of these operators. Now, what you should really say is that in systems that obey the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, the operators you care about obey these properties. All right, that's probably the way condensed matter physicists would say it. Okay, good. So now, almost done. So now that we know these properties, let's use them to estimate this, right? So let's just write it again. So we're trying to estimate e to minus 2 beta EI OIJ the fourth, right? So that's just transcribing this, and remember we've just projected now onto the terms where I equals I prime and J equals J prime. Good. So this is like e to minus 2s, right, because there's two copies of the partition function. This is like e to the 2s because there's two terms in the sum left. This is like e to the minus 2s. Right, because O by itself was e to the minus s over 2, but we've got four of them. So this means that the long time average is e to the minus 2s, but then remember, we squared the correlation function here. So then this implies that g itself is order e to the minus s. So then when we plot this correlation function, we start out at order 1. We decay down exponentially until a time of order the entropy. And then we kind of oscillate around here with a profile, which is set by e to the minus s. Based here, I'm plotting the absolute value. And then over crazily long times, you know, e to the s, sometimes this manages to get back up to being order 1 because the phases all conspire at the cancel. So apparently, the CFT agrees with the bulk at short times. It says that there's this exponential decay. But then at long times, it doesn't agree because it says that we get this e to the minus s instead of the 0. And so that's like our option 3. Remember, option 3 was that, you know, it looks thermal if you don't look too carefully. But then if you look too carefully, it doesn't. There's subtle effects, which are the hallmark of unitarity. And so here we've basically derived that from the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, which I guess we think is true in CFT. So I think it's pretty good evidence for option 3, that, you know, black hole evaporation should be unitary. So let me just close by saying that, you know, the information problem is still, I think, very exciting. As was mentioned in one of the questions, although this at least tells us the answer, that it seems very likely the evaporation is unitary, we still don't really understand how to think about that in the bulk, right? For example, I described that Trans-Planckian problem where, you know, these modes near the horizon are UV sensitive, so maybe somehow the physics is different. But how is it different? What is the theory that's different? What is the bulk calculation that would reproduce these crazy things here? I don't know. I'd love to know. I hope that one of you will explain it to me. All right, thanks. You're in charge.
We have time for, questions. Let's go.
Yeah.
I don't quite understand whether this information problem for the large black hole is the same or related problem with the information problem of the flat space black hole. Or if we understand this, do we understand the other one?
They're not rigorously connected. It's not a reduction like what Dorit was talking about, where I can reduce one problem to the other. They have a similar flavor. It's the same kind of question, right? I do an early perturbation, and then I want to know if at very late times there are things that are still correlated with it.
Yeah, but this version doesn't have anything about interior.
No, but the other one didn't really either, right? It was just a question about the S matrix. You know, you send in a pure state, and then what do you get out? Do you get out a pure state or a mixed state? So both of these are phrased at the boundary. And that's why I'm able to tell you things about them, right? I mean, that's why I feel that's how we've made progress without solving the problem of the interior. But we still need to solve the problem of the interior. Yeah. Yeah. So in ADS CFT, that's apparent. So sorry, the question was if energy is defined at the boundary, shouldn't entropy be defined at the boundary too? Okay. And the answer is yes, absolutely. So in the CFT, this entropy is literally just counting the states in the CFT. Yes, absolutely. I would love to know how to do holography in flat space. You know, it seems harder than doing it in ADS CFT. There is one example, which is the BFSS matrix model. There's Banks, Fischler, Schenker, and Susskind. But I would say it's not totally understood at this level. Although actually there was a recent paper by Masanori Hanada, Jonathan Maltz, and one other person who I don't remember, where they explained in some sense how in these matrix theories you can think about think about evaporating black holes in the information problem. Yeah.
Okay, great. Let's stop for lunch. Thank Daniel again.